One of the most powerful ways to cultivate the perception of not self is to get familiar with what we're taking to be self, what we are calling to be self, what is this sense of self, to study it. I'm recalling that famous quote by Dogen, to study the way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be awakened by all things. The sense of self is such a pervasive feeling. In one of the groups that came up today, that sense of it just feels so true until you start looking at it. It's just so obviously right that there's a me here. But it doesn't bear up under scrutiny. We start looking at it. I think we... The sense of self is really connected to belief, views and beliefs. And those views and beliefs are usually unquestioned. What we take to be self is not questioned. But when we start to investigate, what is this sense of self anyway? Those beliefs begin to be unraveled. The study kind of undermines those beliefs, reveals their delusory nature, the way they shape delusion in the mind. So studying the self, studying the sense of self, what we're feeling, taking to be, experiencing as I, me, mine. The Buddha often used the framework of the five aggregates as a way to explore studying the sense of self. He talked about different ways that the sense of self is created in relationship to the five aggregates. And so knowing something about the five aggregates is a little helpful in terms of this conversation of studying the self. And the study of self in much of the texts revolves around understandings these five aggregates. And so we've named them, and I'm going to just do a very brief overview of these five aggregates today. I'm not going to try to do an in-depth teaching on them. The last two-week retreat I did, I think I did, well, many Dharma talks on the five aggregates, so this teaching can be expanded into many talks. But just briefly, I think, hopefully just to give enough context for the rest of the discussion. And many of you, I think, already have a sense of these teachings. And so I think the talk as a whole will hold together. So the five aggregates are form, feeling, perception, mental formations, and consciousness. Form being the physicality, the physical realm. In the experiential world, it's the sensation level of hardness, softness, warmth, coolness, pressure, heat, tension, liquidity, sense of moisture or dryness, vibration. So basic sensations around movement, around heat, around temperature, sensations around hardness, solidity, and basic sensations around fluidity. And then also understood to be connected to that are the field of sensations associated with the other senses. So the form and color with sight, pitch and tone with sound, salty, sweet, bitter, pungent, with the taste. So just these basic elemental types of sensations is how this realm is experienced. And then feeling is that very simple aspect of experience with every single sensation, every single sense contact has feeling tone. Talked about this the other day with dependent origination, the pleasant, unpleasant, neutral aspect of experience. So this is also, this is understood to be one of these aggregates. And just for a moment, I'm just going to stop and just talk about the word aggregate and kind of the teaching in general. So the word aggregate is translating a Pali term that means, the Pali term is khanda, and it means something like heap or bundle. I understand it's a kind of an ordinary word that was used in that language. You might talk about, you know, bringing a khanda of sticks to the fire, or putting a khanda of rice on your plate or something. So it's a very ordinary word that just means a collection. And so it's kind of like those two examples, the heap of rice, the bundle of sticks. It's a collection of stuff. That's what the khanda is. It's a collection of things, a grouping of things of other things. And the teaching is kind of a way to divide up everything that happens in our psychophysical being. So looking at what happens here experientially, everything that happens in our mind and body experientially will be found in one of these aggregates: body, feeling, perception, mental formations, or consciousness. So this is one of the ways, it's not even the only way, the Buddha divided up the human processes, the human experience. He had another way, the six sense spaces was another way he divided up the human experience. But this particular way, looking at the aggregates, these kind of heaps of things, it emphasizes the mental functions. And so, you know, the six sense bases, for instance, there's five physical senses, each of them being connected with consciousness. And so every sense has its sense object. So the eye and sight and the consciousness there, the ear and sound and the consciousness there. So these six sense bases in that teaching, it's, you know, five of them are physical, and then there's the sense base of the mind, objects of mind like thoughts, emotions, etc. And so the six sense bases teaching kind of divvies up the pie of human experience with a kind of an emphasis on the physical realm to look at that part of experience. And the five aggregates teaching does the flip side. There's only one aggregate for form, for the physicality, and four for the mental realm. And so this teaching on the five aggregates really emphasizes the processes of body, but a lot the processes of mind that function in our human experience. And the heaps that are referred to is like in each of these aggregates, it's not just one thing. So the body is, or the form, as we just talked about, many different kinds of sensations are in that aggregate of form. In feeling, these different kinds of feeling, pleasant, unpleasant, neither pleasant nor unpleasant. And in the sixth sense basis, it points to, because so there's feeling based on sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, and the mind. So there's another kind of way of thinking of it as a heap of feelings. So form, feeling, perception is this functioning of mind that recognizes experience, recognizes what's happening in experience. So one of the main functions of perception is to kind of identify the objects in the world. So hearing, helicopter, seeing wall, seeing zabutons, feeling floor underneath my feet. So there's the sense impression, and then there's a kind of the recognition of it in terms of a conventional object. And this has many levels. It's not just a simple level. So, you know, this thing here that I'm holding, in the visual field, it's round and it's brown. And that's levels of perception before we get to the perception of bell. In the sound field, it's, you know, just kind of like maybe the quality of the tone, the wavering quality, the kind of the round sound of it that identifies it as bell, as opposed to hitting the water bottle. So there are different levels of perception that kind of build on each other. So it's not simple, like I look out and it's all like wall and light and door. There's also the sense of shape and distance and other aspects of that perception. So that's one function of perception, is naming things, essentially, giving concepts, giving labels to experience. And this is a very important function of our human minds that helps us to navigate the world. If we didn't have this, it would be pretty exhausting to get around the world, having to figure out everything that's out there every moment. We can look out, sense the world, and kind of have a sense of what's here based on our familiarity with its contact, with our touch, with our sight, with our hearing. All of it produces this kind of familiar realm. There are some other functions of perception that I think are important to name, and that is perception also recognizes space, time, location. There's a few others, but I don't remember them at the moment. And so at one point meditating in Hawaii, I was on a pretty large property that was in a ruralish area on the slopes of the volcano on Maui. And birds rule on Hawaii. So many different birds, so many different sounds, so many different qualities of the sound, and it just felt like this three-dimensional map of sound, and recognizing that the perception of the location, it almost felt like when a bird called, that the mind kind of projected out into space and landed, you know, so that the mind kind of understood, well, that's, you know, behind me about 50 feet. And kind of just understanding that map of the world based on the sounds. This comes through sight, through contact also, physicality, this sense of location, space, distance. And so these are also important functions of perception. And then volitional formations is this realm, which we've spoken quite a bit about, the realm of mental activities. Spoke this morning about those mental activities that shape our experience. So many of these. This is a real big heap, a heap of stuff. All of the different emotions fall into this category. Thoughts fall into this category. The various flavors of thought fall into this category. Mind states fall into this category. So things like mindfulness are a mental formation. Concentration is a mental formation. Peace is a mental formation. Wisdom is a mental formation. The sense of self is a mental formation. So this is an important area of experience, and the mental formations are kind of those activities of mind that shape choices, intentions, actions. This is the agency of the system. Mental formations is the agency of the system. There's no one single controlling agent, each process arising and having its own agency. And so this is where intention, volition, choice comes in to the system. This is a big place of identification. This is a huge place of the forming of a sense of self. One of the ones we can more easily see, it's a place we can see the sense of self kind of more easily in a way at the beginning. And then consciousness, the fifth aggregate, is this basic process of knowing just every experience, every sense experience, every sight. There's the knowing. There's a knowing faculty that comes with that. Every sound, the knowing of it. Every touch sense and the knowing of it. Every taste and the knowing of it. So there's the quality of the experience, like in the taste sense, there's the bitterness, sweetness, saltiness, pungency, that sourness. There's those flavors that are the object, and then there's the consciousness that knows them. So the knowing quality of mind. Sayadaw says the knowing faculty, the knowing, is a little bit stupid. Those are his words. You know, it's just kind of this contact and, yep, hearing, seeing, smelling. It doesn't do much in the way of discernment, aside from knowing its own sense realm. So seeing consciousness, different from hearing consciousness, different from smelling consciousness and tasting consciousness, mind consciousness. So that's the fifth activity or functioning of mind. It's the fourth functioning of mind, the fifth aggregate. So these four mental functions make up our mental world and are very much what we explore in the realm of looking at the mind. Mental formations is a big part of what we explore in looking at the mind, but we also explore the perceptions, the knowing, the feeling, and how we tend to get caught around these. And this aspect of clinging is where the Buddha pointed to in terms of the mind's kind of struggle around these aggregates. So he termed these the five aggregates of clinging. We tend to cling to these aggregates. We tend to land on them in some place where there will be reliability, happiness. And any of these can be clung to. So there's a discourse that the Buddha uses this framework of the aggregates to explore the three perceptions, and in particular how they kind of come to point to this perception of not self, pointing at the same time to the ways that we tend to land as things being permanent, reliable, controllable, but seeing that they're not, the mind can only understand or begins to understand that experience is not what I took it to be, not a self. The Buddha was pretty careful in the way I think he used his words. He explicitly said when talking about different views that are problematic around self, he named, let's see if I can see this, he named, I'm not going to give you all of these, but he said, the self exists for me is an unwise view. No self exists for me is an unwise view. So he pointed both to, and so this is kind of on the realm of existence and non-existence, landing on the notion of either something stable and solid, self is it, or the absence of the non-existence, no self exists for me. Both of those, he said, are unwise views. They are not views that support the mind being free from suffering. And so what he points to, the way I read the language that he uses in terms of this teaching of not self, is he says something along the lines of, you know, look at what you take to be self, and you will discover that it is not what you think it is. It is not the self you think it is. So that is, to me, the understanding of not self. Not that there is not a self. Again, it's the kind of the conditioned arising. There is a process that's going on here that we conventionally call a being. As that poem from the nun said, these collection of aggregates is conventionally called a being, but no existing being is found. there is a kind of a sense of that being. But when you look at the experience, that sense is revealed to be a misperception, a kind of like it just vanishes, like water into sand. It's just gone. So he uses these aggregates as a framework. In the very first piece in this teaching that he points to, this is what is termed the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta, which is translated as the characteristic of not self. But as I said the other day, that term characteristic is not found in this text. And apparently these titles for suttas were given hundreds of years later. So somebody came along and said, oh yeah, this is about the characteristic of not self. That's what we'll call this sutta. But the Buddha did not use that language anywhere in the suttas. So interesting to recognize that and to remember that he talked about the perceptions of impermanent, unreliable, not self. So the first thing he points to in this teaching is for each of the aggregates, he says, these aggregates are not subject to our wishing. I'll read two of them. Form is not self. If form were self, form would not lend itself to affliction, and it would be possible to determine a form. Let my form be thus. Let my form not be thus. But because form is not self, form leads to affliction, and it is not possible to say a form, let my form be thus, let my form not be thus. Essentially pointing to this element of recognizing the uncontrollable, bumping up against that uncontrollability that we've talked about a few times in the last few days. Noticing the uncontrollable nature. I can't say, you know, may my body not have a fractured vertebrae. It just doesn't work. Mental formations are not self. If mental formations were self, mental formations would not lend themselves to affliction, and it would be possible to determine mental formations. Let my mental formations be thus. Wouldn't that be nice? Let my mental formations not be thus. That would be even nicer. But because mental formations are not self, mental formations lead to affliction, and it is not possible to say, let my mental formations be thus. Let my mental formations not be thus. So really acknowledging this, when we are running up against that uncontrollable nature, it's a pointer to not self. It's evidence. We so often overlook this evidence. You know, this is confirmation bias. It's so obvious that I have a self that we do not notice that the fact that mindfulness appears on its own and disappears when I have the intention to sit down, we do not notice that that's confirmation of not self, confirmation of the not the sense of what I think of as self. That just that view, the belief of the sense of self is so strong, we can have that experience over and over again. We can recognize, you know, oh yeah, I lost mindfulness. Oh yeah, mindfulness came back. I brought myself back, and not notice that it's staring us in the face, this evidence for not self. The uncontrollability of our mind states, the uncontrollability of our body, And so, as we've been, as I've been pointing to, anytime there's a sense of frustration around uncontrollability, I mean, the way even that confirmation bias, when we recognize the uncontrollability of it, sometimes we think it's, well, we either think it's my fault or we think it's somebody else's fault that I'm not able to control this. Or it's the world, it's like the universe conspiring against me somehow. We don't tend to just acknowledge it. This is just the truth of, yeah, uncontrollable experience. This is the way it is. And so this is a key teaching in this sutta, the perception of not self can be seen through this very obvious, ordinary experience that we have all the time. And then the second part of the sutta, he goes through each of the aggregates and connects it to the other perceptions and how these three perceptions connect together. He starts by talking about each aggregate, says, and he's having a conversation at this point. He's having a conversation with the monks he's talking to, and he says, okay, so form, is it permanent or impermanent? They said, yep, it's impermanent, doesn't last. Okay, is what's impermanent reliable? No, it's unreliable. So there's the first two perceptions, just pointing out for every single aggregate feeling. Is it permanent? Impermanent. Not permanent. Is what's impermanent reliable? No. Is it reliable as a lasting source for happiness? No, because it is impermanent. Mind states, permanent or impermanent? So this is, again, pointing back to what's our experience, noticing for each of the arisings in our experience, noticing its impermanent nature is pointed to here as a way into this understanding of not-self. And kind of one of the entryways into understanding this. So we can reflect or look at our experience from that perspective. Okay, impermanent or permanent? Not permanent. What am I taking to be permanent? Noticing that it doesn't last. The uncontrollability of what I take to be permanent. That unreliability of what I take to be permanent. The next pointing is that when we try to land or stabilize to find happiness on something impermanent, that unreliability leads to suffering. And then he goes on to something that it's a little more conceptual in a way. He asks his monks, he says, so does it make sense to call what is impermanent and unreliable a self? And this group of monks agreed that it was not sensible. There are other teachings where the definition or the understanding of what a sense of self is broader than this definition. But in this particular teaching, he just points to, so what is it? You know, does it make sense? You know, he's asking us essentially to reflect on, what do you take to be self? What are some of the fundamental qualities of self? And this group of people felt, you know, in the kind of one of the definitions of self at the time of the Buddha was something that can be landed on as stable and as reliable, as happiness producing. In many ways, we do align with this definition at times, that we think of, you know, what we think of as self. Well, it does feel some stable, you know, when we're not really looking. It's got this pervading sense of some kind of solidity, some kind of kind of as if this being has like there's this the little being in our brain, the homunculus kind of thing, that has been the same from the moment we've been born, and it's been collecting memories and plans, and it's like it's there, it's stable. There is this kind of agent that is in control, that is that sense of something that is kind of carrying through our lives, something that's in control, something that's in charge, some like overriding decider or doer. Or that sense is a piece of what we think of as self, and the Buddha says that's a misperception. When we really look at it, there's nothing stable or solid there. There's nothing stable or solid in what the entirety of our experience. Anywhere we look, anything we look at, any experience we look at, no stability. And so how could there be a stable self in there? That's what he's pointing to with this reflection. And again, the sense of that a sense of self would be something that would lead us towards happiness. And that's a kind of a basic, you know, movement. I think so much of our strategies for navigating the world are that we are trying to find happiness, trying to find a way to land, to feel safe, to feel at ease, to feel happy. And so, you know, I think this definition has its limitations, though, but, you know, there are other definitions. Is this other one page that I referred to, six views. Now I will read them all. The view self, when they attend unwisely, and the unwise attention is basically reflections on self. Was I in the past? Was I not in the past? What was I in the past? How was I in the past? Having been what did I become in the past? Shall I be in the future? Shall I not be in the future? What shall I be in the future? How shall I be in the future? Having been what shall I become in the future? Or else they are inwardly perplexed about the present. Am I? Am I not? What am I? How am I? Where has this being come from? Where will it go? And so these are the kind of reflections that are based on this belief in a sense of self, and then proceed to cement views about self, such as self exists for me, no self exists for me, I perceive self with self as a view, I perceive not self with self as a view. I perceive self with not self. Or it is this self of mine that speaks and feels and experiences here and there the results of good and bad actions. And this self of mine is permanent, everlasting, not subject to change, and will endure as long as eternity. So that, again, the sense of permanence. So those are different kind of flavors. To me, those speak to some other perspectives on the sense of self rather than just this one that's permanent and blissful. But in any case, what I feel that this pointing here, in this particular case, he's talking to a particular group of people, and his teachings were very often tuned to the views that were in the minds of the people he was speaking to. And so he's tuning his teaching to that, looking at, okay, so what are your views about self? Let's look at those. My sense with this teaching is he's pointing to ask these people to explore, what do you take to be self? And start looking at that. Get to know what you take to be self. So exploring, this is comes back to Dogen's very succinct teaching. Study the self. Study what you are taking to be self. Study the experience of self. So what does that mean? Getting to know the experience we call self. Well, as a mental formation, the sense of self, understanding something about this from the perspective of what the Buddha taught, the self being a mental formation, we can explore it just like we explore any mental formation, looking at how it affects the body. How does it affect feelings and perceptions? How does it affect the other mental formations? This morning, after the guided reflection, I reflected on the mental formation shaping our whole, the whole entirety of our experience. Anger shaping the entirety of our experience based on its proclivities, based on its job description. And so we do the same thing with the sense of self. We explore how it shapes the experience. We explore what's the job description of this sense of self. This is one way to explore the sense of self. Another, it's similar, it's maybe just unpacking it in a different way, exploring different ways the sense of self is experienced. We begin to recognize, through this investigation, we start to recognize there's not a single entity that we call self, although certainly there can be this kind of pervading sense of me that I've talked about in that three levels of this is mine, this, you know, the three reflections the Buddha offered. This is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. I think the feeling of me is the most pervading quality that maybe the most sense of stability comes from. That, and so that requires a kind of a subtler investigation. But the first two, we can really start to see that, you know, these various things that we take to be self, these roles or identities that, you know, they mostly fall into one of these two camps, as being someone who owns something, controls something, or somebody who has some kind of a role, who does something. So that experience of different identities, and we start to see different identities that we are very familiar with. The experience of being a sibling for me is very different than the experience of being a child of a parent. You know, that relationship to parent, one thing. Relationship to one parent, one thing. Another parent, another thing. Very different. Senses of self connected with each of those, very different sense of self connected with sibling, different sense of self connected with friends, and so different identities that we have. And we can start to see that these identities form around different things, different aspects of experience. These are also conditioned processes. Our identities are conditioned by many things, conditioned by not only our own experience, but the body that we're born in, the place we're born, the history, the culture that we're raised in. All of that shapes different identities. And again, it feels to me like the process around investigating this is not to come at this with some kind of a contentious relationship with identities as if they're somehow the enemy, but to honor and respect this as another arising, much as we've been doing with whatever is arising, looking at, you know, this is what has come to be. Honoring it, observing it, being with it, what can be learned with it, and allowing the wisdom that develops through that learning to transform the patterns that our mind uses. So it's not about somehow trying to obliterate identities here. These are the identities, in many ways, these identities are, these senses of selves are often strategies that have helped us to navigate the impermanent, unreliable world. They're the strategies that our system has come up with to navigate the world. They've served us to get to where we are. And in a way, we can honor them for getting us here, getting us to the Dharma. And then we can begin to understand what parts of these processes, just like with our habits and patterns of mind, the other day talking about any kind of suffering, pointing to how, you know, maybe something like anger, you know, anger, that experience of the suffering of anger, embedded in that experience is a pointer back to truths of uncontrollable, unreliable. And so, you know, it's just like just right embedded in that is it's connected with that truth, and likewise it's also connected with the wish for happiness and well-being. That kind of balance, or not balance, but just the heart can open to both the truths of impermanent, unreliable, not self, uncontrollable, and these wishes. The strategies of self are also the same way, the same thing. They are strategies that have been navigating these truths and these wishes. Strategies that have been navigating, how can I, this wish for well-being, the wish for happiness, the wish for health and safety, and navigating these truths of impermanent, unreliable, and doing the best they can to figure this out. And basically not having the information to figure out a skillful strategy that's not suffering. And so the medicine of awareness and wisdom, you know, begins to unravel the confusion there around those identities, around the suffering. And transforms the experience, transforms the relationships. But it's not, yeah, it's a different thing. I sometimes use that this analogy or this teaching around, you know, the truths and the deep wishes for well-being. I use this analogy of the, like, these are threads. They're both threads. There's threads of the truths of impermanent, unreliable, and these threads of wishing to be happy and healthy and safe. And basically, the confused mind, it creates a tangle, a knot in the fabric of experience, because the mind doesn't understand how these two can exist simultaneously, and it's trying to figure it out. The senses of selves, the identities are basically these knots in this fabric. And, you know, getting rid of identities, or somehow feeling like the identity is a problem, you know, it's like, well, let's get rid of that tangle. And the strategy we think of is to just, you know, take scissors and cut it out. Let's, you know, get rid of it that way. But then we have a hole in the cloth. And actually, our minds don't let us do that, because it's that knot, that tangle is nothing other than wisdom and love just tangled up. And so I think of the mindfulness and wisdom as being like a lubricant bath that untangles that tangle. So the identities, the suffering kind of just untangles through this process. So it's honoring our identities, honoring our suffering, respecting that this is what's here, the mind opening to this, that the understanding arises for that tangle to untangle. So sometimes a sense of self feels really clear, really obvious, a sense of self-righteousness, for example. This is a good time to kind of be curious about it. Oh, there's one. Let's see, you know, that one feels pretty solid. So let's see what's going on. How's it shaping? What's its job description? How's it affecting the body? And get curious about it. We have identities around certain emotions, certain familiar or habitual emotions that we attribute to be me, or, you know, I am this. This self-hatred, such a strong pattern in this mind for so many years. And it just was assumed that that's what was there. So an identity around it, kind of that piece. But then there's another interesting aspect that we can start to notice around certain identities. If you have a very strong kind of identity, sometimes there's a corresponding, almost opposite identity. And I had those. I had this kind of like, I hated myself, but I also like thought, I'm pretty good at this. I can do this. Looking essentially for ways to prove that I'm not a failure, found ways to feel that I was successful. And so there was this, oh, I'm good at this. Oh, I'm a failure at this, kind of these opposing identities. And what I began to recognize in observing these opposing identities, I felt like, I mean, the suffering was because it was in the failure. The suffering was in the self-hatred. That's where the experience of suffering was felt. The experience of I'm a success, that didn't feel like suffering. So for a long time it was, yeah, oh, that's not a problem. This, you know, whenever I was in the self-hatred, okay, need to look at this, need to observe this, get to know this. The feeling of success, oh. For a while, it just went right by me. At some point, the practice began to reveal that sense of I'm good at this was a setup for feeling like I was a failure. I started to see this out in one retreat where it just went from, you know, I can't do this. I'm a failure. I can't even know what mindfulness is. And then landing with the step and feeling the step fully. It's like, oh, I'm good at this. And just seeing this flip-flop between these two identities and beginning to realize that the I'm good at this, you know, when, you know, 3 minutes later, it was not so easy to see or to land on something. That was in relationship to the idea that I could do that. This control, again, the controlling kind of quality, the sense of this is the sense I'm good at this, demanded that I always be good at this, that I always know how to navigate things. And so when it was proved, you know, the unreliable nature of experience, that not always so, that flipped the mind into the failure mode. And so this kind of dynamic can be something that might be happening, you know, something to kind of be curious about, to look for. Then there's another form of selfing that I want to name that may not be experienced or seen quite as selfing, kind of like I didn't take the sense of I'm good at this to be a selfing. At first I took it to be, oh, that's just what you're supposed to feel like. effective, and, you know, I thought that was a healthy sense of self or a healthy thing. Not seeing the clinging to the need for that control. And so there's another kind of thing that may not be quite seen as selfing, but is a form of selfing, and that is when we notice that we are, what I'll call othering. And so the thoughts may be some, not so much about I or me, and you know, many of our thoughts, some of you have commented on this in the groups, how the vast majority of the thoughts come back to me. You know, almost every single sentence that our mind says has I in it or me in it. But sometimes the thoughts have they and them in it. They're doing this, they're thinking that. This is what kind of, you know, so the sense of creating an other that can happen, you know, just any two people in a room. It can also happen in dependence on skin color. It can happen in dependence on gender or gender identity, this kind of othering quality, this othering happening. But if you are othering, you cannot have an othering without having a self. There's a self there in relationship to that, that often has, that has clinging in it. Because often in that othering, there is some kind of a comparing mind going on, better than, worse than, same as, in that relationship. And so in the othering, there's usually some, you know, you might see somebody doing something. It's like, well, I would never do that. Okay, there's that. I'm better than. Or maybe it's seeing somebody at one time on a retreat. I was retreating with my best friend, and my mind was all over the place, and I would see my friend just like walking with like lifting, placing, so mindfully, and my mind was just like comparing. She would never do this. Othering, projecting, or, you know, projecting what was going on in her mind. I mean, I had no idea. She could have been moving really slowly and having her mind, you know, restless mess. Looked pretty good from the outside. But I projected onto her what I thought her mind state was, and then compared my mind state to hers and found it wanting. So this is, you know, some of what happens for us in this othering process. But also, so much of in this othering also comes in kind of, you know, views and ideas and things that we assume about other people based on history, based on conditioning. And so again, this seeing the process of selfing and othering helps us to recognize some of the delusions at work in our mind. Another way this comes about is not just seeing ourselves doing the othering, but in the feeling of being othered, that we don't particularly hold ourselves in a particular way, but other people see us through that lens, like the sense of other people kind of putting us into categories and boxes, and, you know, actions or, you know, things having arisen from that, laws of, you know, the Jim Crow laws, for instance, you know, who can go where, that these these beliefs, these views, you know, the being othered there creates a very real reality that sometimes in the being othered, it may not seem like it's not like an identity I can let go of, because it's not my identity. It's being put on me. And so there's a challenge there to navigate. I don't have an answer so much for that one, other than to recognize that it is concept affecting the nature of our interactions. And not truth. And it's not to pick it up as being who I am. That I think sometimes is a danger with being othered, that we pick up those identities somehow and kind of believe them internally. So that can be a place to weaken some of the hooks around that. So mostly, again, I want to just end by pointing to this exploration of where and how it feels like we are senses of self, as an exploration that will help the mind to recognize that it's not what we think it is, that it is it's not nothing. This sense of self, as I said, it's a shaper, it's a condition shaping the world. So it's not, the process is not an illusion, but the imputation of a thing to the process is a mistake. And the imputation of solidity to the process is a mistake. And to honoring it, witnessing it through mindfulness and wisdom, curiosity, helps the mind to free from the ways it suffers around clinging. This is the whole purpose of the Buddhist teaching, is this freeing the mind from greed, aversion, and delusion. That freedom from greed, aversion, and delusion being experienced as non-suffering. So let's just sit for a moment.